High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
And good morning to you. I'm Kathy Kalin. This is 101.9 High FM. My gosh, what a time to be alive, huh? When we look at what's happening in the world, so many wonderful, wonderful innovations, stories. It really is filling me with a lot of positivity. Yeah, and I would like to know from you, what is the most positive thing that you've heard in the last 24 hours? I would love to hear from you. Send me a text. We are live this morning, or alive this morning. I don't know. Sometimes it's difficult to tell, I'm saying. But you send me a text on WhatsApp, and that number is 061-895-1019. So this time every week, I talk about people making change in the world. Making positive change. And a regular feature is, organization is the Dis-Chem Foundation, for the simple reason that they do a huge amount of good in the world. So it's natural that we're going to be speaking to them. So joining me this morning from the Dis-Chem Foundation is Jacqueline Kohlberg. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Kathy. How are you?
Very good, thank you. What's the most positive thing that you've heard of in the last 24 hours?
I'm going off to the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital this morning to the Children's Oncology Ward to have a young patient ring the bell because they are cancer-free. Very exciting.
Could we please have... I think the studio audience needs to participate on this. Okay, please say that again.
We're going to a bell ringing at the Chris Hani Baragwanath Children's Oncology Unit to hear the bell being rung by a young cancer survivor.
Well done. That's a wonderful. That is a wonderful, wonderful story. Yes. So is that what they do?
So, yes, when people generally are diagnosed, it's obviously a very long and difficult road. And we have two very esteemed doctors in the room who could definitely speak better to this than I can. But they, especially in the children's ward, they get to ring a bell because they're done with their chemo, they've been deemed cancer-free, and it's a wonderful moment for celebration.
That is fantastic.
So it's very exciting, and I can't wait to get there.
Okay, so we're off to a very good start this morning.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so I would like to introduce you to the two doctors in studio. So joining me this morning from the Charlotte Matseke Johannesburg Academic Hospital are two leading specialists in pulmonary and infectious diseases. Oh, don't we know about that term, infectious diseases, huh? So joining me is Dr. Erica Shaddock and Dr. Sarah Stacey. Good morning to both of you and welcome to High FM. Mm.
Morning, Kathy. Thank you for having us. Morning, Kathy.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time to come. I mean, it's a huge privilege. So Dr. Shaddock is a senior pulmonologist, a researcher whose work focuses on complex respiratory conditions. We're definitely going to talk about that. I want to talk to you about vaping. I want to talk to you about all the different things if we can.
Sure, I have lots of opinions, especially about vaping.
So okay, sure. Excellent, excellent. And I'm meeting more and more people are telling me that they have CRPD. Is it CRPD?
COPD.
COPD. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just become like this jargon that how can I be so unaware of people who have such a serious thing? I definitely want to talk to you about that. Also joining me is Dr. Sarah. Dr. Sarah Stacey, and we're going to be talking about the different infectious diseases. Are infectious diseases also on the rise?
It's difficult to say. I mean, some are on the rise and some are on the way down. I think with recent funding changes in South Africa, we might see a change in the epidemiology forward over the next few years.
It doesn't sound good.
But, you know, there are lots of interesting advances as well. And so some of them are on the way down and some of them are on the way up and some of them are becoming more difficult to treat and
yes.
Some a little easier to treat. So very variable.
Okay. I think that each one of you are talking about things that we could have done an entire hour just with each of you. But we'll see if we can get that into this hour. Okay. So the reason that we're talking to you about Charlotte Matseke and the Dis-Chem Foundation is because of the work that you do for the Dis-Chem Foundation.
Yeah, so we've been very lucky, especially in the pulmonology department, to have had a very large financial contribution or financial support from the Dis-Chem Foundation.
Yes, yes.
They were instrumental in purchasing a very expensive piece of equipment recently. It's called a cryobiopsy machine, which allows us to take better and slightly bigger lung samples during biopsy. There are only three places in the country with this particular piece of equipment. The other two are in the Western Cape, one at UCT and one at Stellenbosch. So we're very grateful that Dis-Chem has allowed us to be at the cutting edge of this particular technology. It is being used more and more throughout the world and is changing the landscape of how we do biopsies of the lungs. In the past, we had to rely on the cardiothoracic surgeons all the time, and they would have to do pretty much open procedures.
Yes.
Whereas now we can do these biopsies just with a scope. So very similar to your gastroscope or your colonoscope, we can now we do a bronchoscope, which is meaning that it's just a small day procedure with this particular piece of equipment that has allowed us to do that. So not only did they purchase the equipment for us, but the foundation, which is through the Better Tomorrow program, but the foundation is supporting us with all the consumables, because as you can imagine, every patient needs a different biopsy needle.
Yes.
So they're helping us with that. And then there's no point having a piece of equipment and not know how to use it, basically.
Right, so you've got to do the training.
So the foundation has supported three doctors in the department. I was one of them. I was lucky enough to go and do some extra ultrasound, lung ultrasound training in the UK. And then two of our other pulmonologists have traveled to Greece to do an extensive program in interventional pulmonology, where they learned not only techniques and how to use the cryobiopsy, but also other interventional, newer interventions that you can do that are not as invasive, that we could go and do with the equipment we had. So it was you're learning more skills on equipment that we already had. So it has just blown up the amount of procedures and investigations we can do for our patients, especially those really tricky ones where, you know, we don't know the diagnosis.
What's so interesting is in the past we've seen, when we've seen increase in figures it's because more people are being more accurately diagnosed rather than there being an actual rise in conditions. Do you find that to be true still, or are there actually a rise or conditions that are rising?
I think it's probably a combination of both. Just as an example, on a, I would say, weekly or monthly basis, we have patients that come in having been diagnosed with tuberculosis at their local clinic and then started on, and not just at their local clinic, their GP, wherever, both in public and private. And they haven't got a confirmed TB diagnosis. But obviously, someone looks at the x-ray, they decide it's South Africa, it has to be TB, started on TB treatment. You know, 3, 4, 5 months later, they're still not better. They then present to us at a tertiary level hospital, you know, and then we make the diagnosis with various different options, and it's cancer and not TB. So something like that will go down in the TB registry as tuberculosis, but actually it's cancer. And those kind of diagnoses would definitely skew the stats. So then we were going to be thinking that both tuberculosis and cancer is on the rise, but it's often a misdiagnosis. So as you say, we're getting better at making diagnoses, so those conditions appear more frequent.
What is this machine called?
So we do a conventional video bronchoscopy, which is similar to your gastroscope and colonoscopy, and then
put a little camera in.
Little camera into the lungs. We jam our camera as far down as we can go. And then a probe is placed through a very narrow channel, and that is fed either visually where we see it's going, or we do what we call blind biopsies. And this particular probe will go into the lung, if we're doing it blind, all the way to the edge. And then it is attached to a very fancy machine, this cryo machine, that then freezes a portion of tissue using various gases, and I think we're using argon at the moment, and then that will freeze a portion of the lung.
Argon that you use for welding.
I'm not a good welder, so I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
Well, you might. You never know. I'm sure argon's a gas.
It is a gas. It is a gas.
It's so used for welding.
It freezes that particular tissue at, that's obviously amazing, the temperature, a much lower temperature, like I suppose dry ice would be another example. And then we're able to then just, you know, for lack of a better word, yank that piece of tissue out with the forceps. And because it's frozen, we get a bigger sample, yes, and there's less bleeding because obviously cold freezing the tissue has, you know, what we would have called cryoed all the blood vessels.
Yes.
So we're now able to get much bigger samples. So in the past...
And it's safer.
Much, there is a higher risk that we pop the lung because we're taking a bigger piece, but we can manage those complications quite easily. There is a higher risk of bleeding, but again, we have ways of dealing with that. But again, the fact that we can go in, get a sample, come out, patient goes home same day without having a big cut in their chest to get that particular sample is it really has changed the landscape for a large amount of our patients.
And the recovery,
yeah, there's
amazing.
You know, if you don't have a complication, recovery is, you know, instant. It's not, these patients go home and, you know, if depending on how quick your pathologist is, you have a diagnosis anywhere from a week to 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Okay, so now Dr. Stacey, hello and welcome to you.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you.
Infectious diseases, obviously, clearly the two of you work together very closely.
Yes, we do.
So I just want to introduce to our listeners that Dr. Stacey is Dr. Sarah Stacey. She's an infectious disease expert. She leads the hospital's antimicrobial stewardship program. What is that?
So antimicrobial stewardship has become a very important focus of infectious diseases. And I often joke that I'm an infectious diseases specialist, but what I try and do is stop people prescribing antimicrobials. That's a large part of my job.
Would that be antibiotics?
Antibiotics, antifungal agents, antiviral agents. So there are, you know, yeah, there are a variety of options for killing organisms.
Yes.
When antibiotics became a thing, you know, and I think we need to realize that antibiotics are only 100 years old. You know, penicillin came around in the 1920s, first found in the 1920s. And they were a miracle drug. You know, suddenly, people, soldiers in war who had terrible injuries weren't dying of infections because you could prescribe an antibiotic to prevent the infection from occurring. And people didn't realize necessarily at that stage that organisms, bacteria in particular, but also fungi and viruses, are very good at developing mechanisms for escaping the effects of antimicrobials. And it happened immediately. As soon as antibiotics were being prescribed, organisms developed ways to evade the effects of antimicrobials. And it took us a while to realize that.
Like 100 years?
Well, not quite 100 years, but close on 100 years, probably, yeah. 50 years.
Yeah.
Some of the antimicrobials that were developed subsequent to penicillin, there were organisms that were resistant to those antimicrobials before those antibiotics or antifungals were even released onto the market. And there were really no restrictions on prescribing antimicrobials. And certainly when I was a kid, my mom would take me to the doctor, and I would get the banana-flavored or strawberry-flavored.
Do you remember that? Antibiotic. It never actually tasted like... I used to love the taste of it.
Oh, really? Oh, God, I thought it was terrible.
Disgusting.
I thought it was terrible. You had to store it in the fridge.
Yes,
I think everybody remembers that.
Yes. I can even smell it as you're saying that.
No, absolutely. And those antibiotics were almost certainly unnecessary. Almost certainly, every time I went to see the doctor with a runny nose, I had a viral infection and the antibiotics did absolutely nothing. But that was common practice. And it's now a practice that we need to start avoiding. We need to start restricting the prescription of antimicrobials to make sure that you actually have an infection caused by an organism that can be treated with that particular drug. It has to be specific. It has to be as narrow a spectrum as possible. It has to be given for as short a time as possible. It should be given orally rather than intravenously. I think that's really the crux of antimicrobial stewardship, is that we need to be very, very careful with how we prescribe antimicrobials because we are running out of them.
Can we talk about what infectious diseases are on the increase and what are on the decline?
So I think we're starting to see more resistant organisms. So they aren't necessarily organisms, the patients aren't necessarily, certainly in the hospital, they aren't necessarily getting more infections. but they're getting infections that are more difficult to treat. And part of that is also about infection prevention and control, how you manage a patient in the hospital to prevent the infection going from one person to another person sitting in the same cubicle or in the same ward. And what we're finding is that a lot of environmental organisms in hospitals, which we were able to treat with less specific antibiotics. So the common term is people say strong antibiotics, and it's not a strong antibiotic. It's an antibiotic that that
more
treats a broad spectrum of agents. And so now we have these very advanced antibiotics that have been developed more recently, but they're often very broad spectrum. And so now we're having to use those antibiotics to treat bacteria that don't respond to other antibiotics, but we're also killing all sorts of other antibiotics, and in doing so, allowing the resistant organisms to survive. So we're certainly seeing a rise in hospital-acquired infections that are more difficult to treat.
Is that like the MRSA?
So MRSA. So interestingly enough, in South Africa, MRSA is not a huge problem. It's not as big a problem as it is, for example, in the States. But we're seeing. And, you know, I can give you the names of the organisms, but you know, they're not going to make any difference. Yeah. So MRSA is one, but there are a variety of other what we call gram-negative organisms, and those are a big problem in our hospitals here in South Africa.
No, we definitely. I mean, I think we've probably all heard about someone that we know who's gone into hospital for one thing, and developed, you know, either sepsis or some kind of infection that's laid them up for much longer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what you're talking about.
And it makes it, you know, it's a huge impact from a personal point of view for those patients, but also from an economic point of view, because now patients spend much longer in hospital, they require more interventions, they go home later. You know, it's a big deal.
What about infectious diseases like polio?
So polio is in this country, it's pretty stable. We don't see a lot of polio. I'm a little nervous to say this, but sometimes what we see is we're seeing the cases of polio that we see are what are known as vaccine-derived polio cases. They're extremely, extremely uncommon, but we don't see wild-type polio at the moment. There are parts of the world in which wild-type polio is still an issue. It's still circulating, and certainly in areas where there is humanitarian stress, you know, war and that sort of stuff, polio resurfaces, because vaccine programs and so on can't be implemented properly. But, you know, polio here, we don't really see it.
Measles?
Measles, we're having an outbreak at the moment. And we're actually also having a small rubella outbreak at the moment. These are obviously vaccine-preventable diseases, and what the Department of Health is doing is catch-up programs, particularly in kids. So, you know, if there are a few children who may have missed measles, or they didn't respond appropriately to their measles vaccine, or they just need a boost or something like that. So they go into the schools and so on, and they boost vaccine protection.
Yeah. So how is Dis-Chem helping what you do?
Well, I must
Dis-Chem
say
Foundation.
That we were unfortunately outcompeted. By the pulmonology department for this particular piece of funding.
And yet you still came to the interview.
And I still share an office with Dr. Shadog. but we have had some discussions about ways to modernize our service delivery with Dis-Chem. We hope that we'll hopefully be able to take those discussions forward a little bit in the future.
Okay. All right. Jacqueline,
yes,
tell me about Dis-Chem Foundation, why Dis-Chem Foundation has chosen the pulmonology and the infectious diseases at Charlotte Mateke.
So in a conversation a couple of years ago, two years ago, we Roy put into place the Better Tomorrow initiative, and a vote, the 22,000 plus strong Dis-Chem employees were asked, what matters to you? Where would you like to see an improvement or better help you know, for people that there's a serious need for. And one of the things that came back is treatment of tuberculosis cancers for people that don't, you know, they don't have medical aid, they're not able to afford it. And in discussions with Dr. Shaddock, it became apparent that there was this phenomenal machine, and she's spoken to it at length and explained a great deal of its abilities. And so we decided to get involved with that so that we can help people, and not just people at Charlotte, but nationally. So as Dr. Shaddock said, the doctors have gone out, they've done the studies, and they'll share that with their colleagues as well. So not just the three of them have been further upskilled, but they will now share that information. And this was important to us, not just for, I think, so many members of the public have been affected by tuberculosis, the cancers, when it hits the lungs. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And Dr. Shaddock, I want to ask you to speak to the
Pleurix catheter bags.
The Pleurix catheter bags as well, which we work with, which is absolutely fascinating and a beautiful thing that the foundation are able to assist with as well, from a longevity of end of life and dignity. So it's a good initiative. It's changing the way biopsies are done, and it's helping people. And people don't want to stay in the hospital longer. They want to go home. They're scared. So from that point of view, just holistically, it just works for the foundation. It speaks to better health. It speaks to all of these things.
Dignity is a big part of foundation's
always
values. And I hear that every single week and every show that we do, Jacqueline.
Always. And Dr. Stacey, while she very gently pointed out we haven't really done anything with her department yet, the work that she did during COVID should not go unnoticed or unspoken of.
Okay, so let's talk about the catheter bag.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about COVID work.
Perfect. We don't want to dwell on COVID because it's hopefully a thing of the past, but just the work that she's doing. And
I don't know, some people have very long-term effects of it, I guess.
But we'll shoot that one across. Okay,
let's carry on. Dr. Erica Shaddock, tell us about these catheter bags.
So unfortunately, there are patients who have metastatic cancer, whether it be lung, breast, wherever the original site was.
Metastatic meaning that it travels in your blood to different organs.
Yes, it either is a direct spread or can go via the bloodstream. And then this particular, the pleural space, which is the space between your lung and your chest wall, which obviously we have to allow for, you know, it's a well-lubricated space, it allows for good movement, that's why it exists. But sometimes the cancer ends up in that space. Again, whether it's through direct spread from the lung or blood spread from other parts of the body. And in patients with cancers that are unfortunately stage 4, that are not being able to be treated, that sits in the pleural space, it makes this large volume of fluid. You know, the cancer is just a very busy cell, and that cell is going to result in large outpouring of fluid. This fluid then builds up in that space, compressing the lung and obviously making patients terribly uncomfortable, both from a pain point of view and an ability to breathe. And then these patients have to then come in regularly for what we call pleural taps, which is we unfortunately have to put a needle into their chest, drain off a liter to whatever of the fluid.
A liter, that's a lot. Hey? Is that normal?
There's usually anywhere from 500 mils to 5 liters in their chest. But we drain these off regularly so that they then can, you know, go home, be with their family. But the problem is that's a procedure every time coming into the hospital, a needle getting, you know, jabbed into you. So there are these amazing catheters, which unfortunately are quite pricey and not on government tender, that we can place this, you know, silicon catheter directly into this particular space. It's fixed into the chest through a number of different mechanisms, initially a couple of stitches, but then your body, you know, kind of granulates around that, and then it's there permanently. Mm. They can be removed if necessary, but that's not the plan with these particular patients. So then the catheter resides in that pleural chest cavity, and it's got a little tap, which can be connected to a bag. But what we normally do is just roll it up, keep it nice and sterile against the patient's chest wall, and then we teach the patient how to drain at home. So they then just unclamp the drain and then drain off the fluid at home, in their own home, you know, every time they feel a bit short of breath, and then they clamp again. Obviously all sterile.
It keeps them in control.
And then it keeps them at home,
yeah,
without having to come into the hospital and catch all of those multi-drug resistant bugs that Sarah was telling you about. And it also allows them to, you know, not have needles jabbed into them regularly. And it really gives the – and this and these unfortunately are end-of-life catheters that are inserted. So these particular patients, you know, whether they've got 1 month, 6 months left to live, they don't have to give up a huge amount of that particular special time to spend it at the hospital. They can be at home with their family and not wait until they've got 6 liters of fluid in their chest before it gets drained. They do it at home. And the South African population is very adaptable and is able to learn to do these things at home.
Yeah.
And we have there is a nurse attached to the particular company that trains the patients. But I was speaking to a colleague in the UK. Where
does this Kim fund that as well?
They do fund the catheters for us.
The catheters and the training?
The nurse comes with the catheter from the company. So luckily, that is part of the catheter process.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but in a country like the UK, where they have the NHS, where there are nurses who come to your house, those particular patients never learn to drain themselves because they have no need to, because obviously there's a government facility that comes and does it. So my colleagues in the UK were quite surprised to find out how well the South Africans just do draining it themselves at home.
South Africans are exceptional people.
Yeah, so it's just really interesting to see how the bags are different in which parts of the world. But it really gives patients back time, comfort, and as Jackie said, dignity. They don't have to feel obliged to the hospital for their care.
Absolutely incredible. Mm. So if this scheme wasn't funding it, would you still have access to that?
Not at all.
Okay, that's the bottom line. All right. Mm. Thank you, and thank you, Dis-Chem Foundation, once again for funding life-saving, dignity-saving, well, not life-saving, life-extending, I suppose, right? Because you said that it's...
It doesn't extend life. It just
makes it more comfortable.
Makes patients more comfortable. It's what we call palliative care.
Yeah.
It's about allowing patients to be pain-free and comfortable for as long as possible at home.
Okay. Dr. Sarah, can we please talk about your work during COVID?
Well, I must confess that...
another one, Jacqueline. Are you taking notes?
I'm leaving now.
I missed the first wave of COVID because I was off on maternity leave. by the time I got back, Erica and colleagues had pretty much figured out how to treat COVID. When Delta arrived the following year, it was still extremely stressful and very time consuming and not a fun time for any of us.
Did we have the same sort of scenarios that they had overseas? I remember seeing from the Italian hospitals. It seemed like South Africa, either we didn't have the coverage of it or it wasn't as devastating.
So I think you need to ask Erica about the first wave, because I wasn't there for the first wave.
Yeah.
You know, I heard about it on the phone, but I wasn't in the hospital. My impression certainly is that it was pretty much the same.
You know, obviously, COVID was managed by multiple specialities.
Yes.
Pulmonology and ID were at the forefront because of how the disease was, and obviously the intensive care departments. And I think our stats are probably maybe not as good as, say, they are in Europe, so we can't actually give you proper numbers. But I think one of the reasons countries like Italy did worse than we did, obviously they were at the very beginning, so they didn't have anybody to learn from. But second of all, they had a much older population. So because South Africa's population is so much younger, this was a disease that took out the elderly and those with comorbid conditions.
Yeah.
And we often talk, and, you know, recently it's 5 years since COVID this year, obviously, when we had the first patients. And there were a lot of, where were you 5 years ago discussions, or do you remember this photo? You know, do people remember blowing their trumpets, you know, when everybody was at home? And And I must be honest, a couple of us have got quite serious PTSD from that whole time period.
I can see just the minute we started talking about COVID, your body language changed.
Yeah, it was not a fun time at all.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to trigger your PTSD.
We work both in the wards and in ICU, and I did some private and some government work. And obviously in government, it was a resource nightmare. But on that same sentence in private, we ran out of ventilators in private at the particular time. So it was a catastrophe. I think we only thank goodness for massive initiatives initially run in the UK, a big study called Recovery, that was amazing at recovering data and collecting data so that we then eventually knew how to manage these patients.
Yeah.
And that was never funded by any pharmaceutical agency or something. It was, purely research-driven data capturing. But please God, not again in any of our lifetimes.
Please God, please God. Please
we
God.
Obviously learned a hell of a lot. And, you know, people don't test for COVID anymore. It's out there now as a normal virus that's catching us.
A different strain, though.
It's a completely different strain because that's the whole point. Viruses don't want to... Good viruses like flu, COVID, HIV, for instance, don't... And when I mean good, I mean successful viruses. Don't kill people off so that they can't spread the virus. And COVID's now mutated to the point where just a common cold almost now. So
it's almost parasitic, the way that you explained that.
Well, I sometimes wonder, aren't we just big parasites for the viruses and fungi that travel around with us in our bodies?
We are definitely only the hosts.
Yeah. and so hopefully never again. But we certainly learned a lot about ourselves, the community, and just everybody during that time period. And we made lots and lots of mistakes, and we learned a lot. Hopefully that knowledge is now with us, and there's lots of systems in place that we have benefited from going forward.
But in what scenario, other than the COVID one, could we have learned as much as we did in such a short, intense period of time?
Obviously, I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's anything. Maybe an influenza outbreak. Maybe
it's not the nature of the disease. It's not COVID itself. It's the nature of a pandemic.
Yeah.
And it's the same with HIV. You know what I mean? If you look at how the short period of time that we learned so much and got drugs so quickly, it has to be an emergency.
Yeah.
The whole world has to take it on for it to be important.
And I think that's what people don't realize at the moment is that this multi-drug resistant. Crisis that we're in at the moment. You know, when HIV came out, they developed within the space of, 5-10 years, effective therapy. And people don't realize that what we're facing at the moment from an AMR point of view is the same sort of crisis that we faced when HIV arrived.
So can we talk about HIV?
Sure.
I've been seeing that the numbers are on the rise. Is that true?
No, not really.
Amongst young people.
So young people is a particular. So that's adolescents are what we call a key population.
Yeah.
And the problem with adolescents now is that they didn't see what HIV did when it was untreated, 20 years ago. So we only started rolling out ARVs in 2004 here. There were a few people who accessed it through trials and through private doctors and so on, but the national HIV rollout only started in 2004. And at that stage, people
were...
Sure,
that was late, hey?
Very late, very late. I mean, that's a whole nother political story.
HIV was first identified in the 1980s.
In the mid-80s, yeah. Yeah. And overseas, ARVs were being given. I mean, they were terrible ARVs in those days. They were,
but it was something.
They were horrible to take, and they made you feel terrible and had lots of side effects. But
wild potatoes and showers.
Beetroot and whatnot. Anyway, so kids today don't have a memory of that. So now. You're HIV positive. You started taking your ARVs in 2004 as a 30-year-old woman, and now you are a 55-year-old woman, and you're absolutely fine, and your ARVs are one tablet a day, and you're doing okay. And adolescents don't recognize this as a disease that they need to be afraid of. And, you know, obviously it's a treatable disease. And if you take your ARVs and you adhere to your therapy, you're going to be fine. But there's no need to acquire it in the first place.
Dr. Stacey, how much of ARV contraction is socioeconomically driven? And the reason I ask this is because when I see the statistics of teen pregnancies, right, if you're having unprotected sex, it could just as well be HIV that you're getting.
Yeah.
Especially if it's from, you know, the blessers or, I mean, there's a whole culture and around this.
Yeah.
That's why I ask.
Yeah. So the WHO has an HIV program goal, which is 95, 95, 95, which means 95% of people need to know their HIV status. 95% of those people who are HIV positive must be on ARVs, and 95% of people on ARVs must be virally suppressed. There is also what's known as U equals U, which is undetectable, means untransmissible. So when we do a blood test to see what the viral load is, which is basically the count of how much virus is in the bloodstream, if it's undetectable, if the machine can't detect the virus in the bloodstream, the chance of you transmitting to somebody else is virtually zero. Now, in medicine, we never, you know, we don't say 100% and we don't say 0%, but it's virtually 0%. So if people are on their ARVs, unprotected sex is actually not high risk for transmission. But it's people who are not on ARVs or who don't know their status who are having sex across generational gaps, who are potentially the risk for that adolescent key population to acquire HIV.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Can we talk about, I think we've spoken about what's on the increase, but just getting back to you, Dr. Shaddock, can we talk about vaping?
Oh, my goodness. can of worms. Yeah, can of worms.
So I have a particular interest in vaping and the unethical practices of the tobacco industry. What we can very clearly say that vaping is not safe. And this whole story where they talk about 95% less harmful. I'm not sure if you've seen that statistic.
No.
The vaping companies love it. It's on all of their billboards, and the fact that there are vaping billboards is another catastrophe, in my opinion. But it's their tagline. And if you look at any, and online is where people do things these days, if you go to any vaping website, that statistic will be there. Vaping is 95% less harmful than smoking. Yeah. It will be there, that specific statistic. And they will reference it. And it is a referenceable, you know, stat. But what people don't know is how that particular statistic was. Yeah.
Context is important.
Yeah. So just let me describe this particular study to you. The one and only study is they got, you know, about, I think it was 20 people who sat around a table. These 20 people were epidemiologists, some pulmonologists, some infectious diseases, some psychologists. And they literally sat around a table and they were asked questions about how harmful do you think X, Y, and Z is? And obviously they compared cigarettes, hookah smoking, snuff, all the different tobacco things. Literally it was people sitting around a table, okay, and asking questions like, do you think vaping will result in aggression or anger? And obviously these people wrote, no, they don't think so. And the entire statistical analysis that came out of this particular study is people's opinion around a table 20 years ago when there was no information out there. And so this statistic has been used, unfortunately, by Public Health England, which has...
Why hasn't it been challenged?
It has been challenged extensively
and they still use it?
Well, it is a piece of scientific... Well, I don't want to use the scientific...
Opinion isn't scientific.
Well, that's how we feel about this. But nobody goes and looks at that. So what I can tell you about vaping is that this came to market without any clinical studies. There was no evidence to suggest that it was better than cigarettes or other conventional methods for quitting. This product came to market and resulted in the medical community having to do research about it. And what the medical community has found is that it's not safe. We don't have, unfortunately, 30, 40 years of data, which is what it takes to show you, which is what it took to show you that smoking causes cancer. We don't have that, okay? And my big feeling is that if this was a product that was supposed to help with smoking cessation or for you to switch, why has it been, you know, flavored with, you know, blueberries and cheesecake and whatever other crazy...
Because smoking stinks. That's
well,
why.
For sure. But, you know, what it has done is it has dragged in the adolescent.
It's keeping people addicted to the nicotine. It's just your delivery system that's different. And because it's not like a cigarette where you have to draw against the cigarette, people are inhaling it deeper into their lungs. It's a crazy thing. And nobody's challenging it.
We also don't know.
I say this as a non-smoker.
You know, the problem is when I ask a patient how many cigarettes they smoke, they can tell me how long a box lasts. But you can't quantify vaping because it's how hard you suck on it, how often you pick it up. It's very, very difficult to quantify. And all the vaping companies are, drumroll please, are owned.
Okay, wait, he's getting you a drumroll. Okay. He's actually getting you a drumroll. Craig, we need a drumroll. Here we go.
Okay. It's quite a long... are owned by the tobacco companies.
Yes. And now see that you can get sucking sweets.
Yes, and there's nicotine, little pouches that go... This is the new thing in the schools, unfortunately, is these pouches that you can easily hide in the corner of your mouth. So nobody knows you're doing it. And the rapid increase in nicotine addiction in the schools or the school-going people across the world, but in this country, is phenomenal. You just have to speak to teachers and they'll tell you. And there has been work done down in Cape Town by Prof. Richard van Dale Smit, which has shown how addicted high school goers, students are to this particular product.
I get it. And medium term, it's a fantastic business plan, but long term, you're going to kill your business. Right.
Well, you just have to get a younger person addicted.
It's absolutely shocking. Shocking. Mm. All right. That is where we have to love and leave you. Mm-hmm. Wrap up. But I'm giving you the last word, Jacqueline. So I just want to say thank you so much to Dr. Erica Shaddock, who is a pulmonologist, and Dr. Sarah Stacey, who's the head of infectious diseases, both from the Charlotte Mateka. You are incredible. I wish that I had an hour with each of you to talk about your areas of expertise. Really. And just thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks,
Kathy. I don't know how you do it, but thank you for doing
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having us.
Jacqueline, I'm going to leave the last word to you because the Dis-Chem Foundation is just, you just show up. You show up. If it was a man, I would date you.
Oui.
I'm telling you, the Dis-Chem Foundation, it's amazing because you're in it for the long term, firstly. I don't have to tell you. Tell me where to from here with Charlotte Motseke, with this particular Better Tomorrow project?
Well, as you can hear, the two doctors and their teams in the hospital are doing such phenomenal work and research, and it's ongoing continuously. So I think there's just a few more discussions, particularly with Dr. Stacey, and we'll see where it takes us. But the difference they're making every day is amazing, and we thank you. We thank you for the lives that you save, the lives that you're able to change, and just for the phenomenal work you do in the public sector every single day. From the Dis-Chem Foundation, from Dis-Chem, from Better Tomorrow, we thank you. And all our loyal customers just
And from Dis-Chem Shoppers.
Woo! And Dis-Chem Shoppers. Keep swiping your Better Rewards cards.
Better Rewards. And you don't have to get a new card. If you don't have a card, get a card. But you can use your old one and you will still get the Better Rewards. I did.
New one's prettier.
Jacqueline. All right. Thank you so much. Mike Lubo, very quickly, a question. Does sucking a vape harder make the burn hotter? And does this then burn the lungs?
So...
That's a good question, actually.
It is. It doesn't make it any hotter. It would be about the delivery of the amount of vape... or gas, vapor is the correct word, the amount of vapor you would get. So you would get it, you would get a higher concentration and it would potentially go in deeper. But the temperature is what is used to vaporize the liquid. It's not the vapor's not hot or warm or any of that.
Just smells like raspberries or whatever. Yes. And to you, I want to say thank you so much for joining me this week. Please God, we will be back next week. And then we need to start looking up towards the end of the year. Jacqueline, can you believe it?
Yeah, it's been fast.
It's just gone. But I wish you a wonderful, wonderful weekend. It's in sight.
Thank you.
It's loading. Thank you so very, very much. And I will be back with Jacqueline next week. For myself, Kathy Kayla, thank you so much to my guests, Dr. Erica Shaddock, who's a pulmonologist at the Charlotte Masekela Hospital, as well as Dr. Sarah Stacey, who is the head of infectious diseases. Thank you both very, very much. And Jacqueline Kahlberg, thank you and keep up the good work.
Thank you for having us all.
God bless. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.